So, we're going to try to analyze different aspects of the healthcare discussion and the role and responsibility of government in this process. So, we'll start off by kind of discussing kind of a global perspective on the role of the collective responsibility to provide healthcare for others. Okay? And then we'll get into some specific issues and how that relates to, certainly historically, how in the times of the Gemara, before and after, they dealt with some issues involving providing communal health care. Obviously, we did have for many, many centuries a Jewish community that was self-sufficient, that was self-reliant. So we dealt with these issues. On different levels, we had to deal with these issues. And health care maybe didn't look like it does now with insurance companies and HMOs, but still, you have to deal with the fundamental question of how to provide health care for the masses, certainly those who could not afford it. So we'll see some of the ways that was handled, some of the issues that came up in some of the ways that was handled, but also had more global scale as well. Okay, so I have a lot of sources here, and I can get to all of them, but we'll kind of skip around a little bit, but I wanted to give you some more to look at in your own time if you'd like to kind of delve into it further. Okay, source number one. So, the responsibility of doctors. So there's a well-known Mishnah that says, Tov sheberofim legehenim, that the best of doctors, they end up in a place south of the border. The best of doctors end up in hell. Right? It's an odd statement. What would that mean? The best of doctors end up in hell. All doctors are terrible people. So that can't be. So what does it mean? So Rashi says, Tov shiburof shlikahendim, v'yesh biyadu l'rapo sa'anig v'enim rape. That ultimately, there will come a time that, with great power comes great responsibility, and with great potential to help others, there's almost this overarching obligation to help others. And almost by definition, once you put yourself in a situation where you have the ability to help others, certainly to help heal others, you can't help everyone, right? It's impossible, it's impractical to help every single person in every single scenario. So inevitably a doctor, throughout their life, will do things that they'll make mistakes, or they will simply not do as good of a job as they could have done, or not be there for people when they need help. If a doctor wished, they could work 24 hours a day. There's no shortage of places they could work, they could volunteer, they could be a part of. So even the best of doctors, Tosha Brofim, we're not talking about the ones that are lazy, the ones that cut corners, the ones that, look, like any field, there's going to be the good and the bad. But even the best of doctors will not have a perfect record and will not always be on call. So, Toshib Rufim Likahena means that if Hashem were to really judge every single doctor according to the letter of the law, you could say, according to their potential, they will always come up short. So therefore, in that sense, they have to be called into account, to take an accounting for what they've done. Okay. So that's just kind of as a way of introduction. We're dealing with an impossible situation, right? Almost by definition, there's no perfect solution to any of this. We're counterbalancing two very different things. In one sense, we need to make sure we have good doctors. We need to make sure they're incentivized to be doctors. We need to make sure that we have a system in place that's fair to them as well, that doesn't overwork them, that doesn't make it impossible to do the job. At the same time, we need to make sure that we're providing health care for people. We obviously don't want people getting sick and dying left and right. So how do we balance those two things? I mean, that's based, so in certain times in life, we're dealing with conflicting goals, and we try to find some sort of happy medium and try to find ways to maybe regulate it on some level. So that's, right away, we're showing that's what we're trying to do, but there's going to be some difficulties, some complications in the matter. Okay, so the first pasuk we're going to deal with here is in Vayikra. So this third source, Vayikra, Perek Yutet, Pasuk Tet Zayin. So Lo Ta'amud Al Dam Re'echa Ani Hashem. So we're told that we're not allowed to stand on the blood of our neighbor, because I am Hashem. What does it mean to stand on the blood of your neighbor? So, so the Gemara understands it as follows. So the Gemara says in Gemara in Sanhedrin Daf Ayin Gimel Amud Aleph, Minayin L'Roat Chaver Shu Tova Binar. So how do we know? Let's say someone is drowning in the river, or they're being attacked by a wild animal, or listen ban or love, or they are being robbers are attacking them. Shuchayv latzilo. How do we know that we're obligated to help save them if we can? And if I'm just going to be killed myself, then right, there's no mitzvah, because then all we're doing is killing both of us. But if I could potentially help, but I'm putting my life somewhat in danger, how do we know I'm obligated to do so? I could argue if I endanger my life even 1%, you know. So let's say you have 100% chance of dying from this encounter, from this situation, but there's a 1% chance I could die by trying to help you. So who says I'm obligated to risk my life by 1% to save you, even though you're 100% chance to die without my help? Who's to say? So Gemara says, "Tamalomar lo tamod amriyacha." So this pasuk teaches us that I'm obligated to do my part to help save others, right? And obviously, what's happening now with after the hurricane, something that we all have to certainly take into consideration. What part do we play? What is our obligation to help those who have been affected, right? So we're obligated. We're obligated to do something, to do what we can, right? It's not enough to say, "Well, you know, didn't happen to me." We have to take it upon ourselves as our responsibility to help in situations where we can help. So.
Is there a difference between the government being obligated and the individual?
So we're going to take this to the government. So the first step is the individual, but then the next step is what about collectively? So there's an individual responsibility to help others. But you could therefore infer, and we'll see the sources back this up, that once there's an individual responsibility, there's a collective responsibility. So the extreme case is someone's drowning in the river and I walk by. So that's the immediate need. But what about people who can't afford health care or will die without it? So now there's a collective responsibility. So that's still lo tamod amriyacha, which we'll see. So that's kind of an extension of that concept, in a more organized, communal way. So the Rambam takes this further and says in the next source, this is the Rambam in Hilchos Rutzeach Lishmiras Nefesh, Perek Aleph Halach Yadalib. Over a lot of time, so anybody who has the opportunity to save someone and doesn't, so they have violated this commandment of standing on the blood of their fellow. So this is the case that the Gemara brought. If you see someone who's drowning in the river, you see someone who's being attacked by robbers or by wild animals, and you can help them and you don't. Or beyond that, let's say it's not just me myself. Let's say I can't do this, right? I don't know what I'm doing. But I could pay someone to help them, right? So then I'm also obligated to do that. If I can pay someone to help this person because I don't have the skill to do it myself, so then I have to do that, right? So let's say someone's drowning in the river and there's a person over there with a boat and he'll only go out there for $20. So then I'm obligated to pay it, right? That becomes my responsibility. Oh, so shama goyim omosrim machshav malav ra, o tamin lapach v'lo golab ozen chaver yadir. Or I hear that there's some sort of plot to capture someone or to take someone captive, and I don't tell the person, I don't warn them. So that's also, I'm not looking out for the other person. I'm obligated to tell them, to warn them. I know, you know, even though I might put myself at risk, if you know that, you know, certainly in times in Jewish history where Jews could be captured for doing nothing or for being suspected of all sorts of things. So if you know that the secular government is after somebody, and by telling the other person, you're putting yourself at risk, right? Because you're revealing secrets to the government. If they find out that someone, you know, spilled the beans, then they're going to go after that person. So too, I'm still obligated to tell them, even though I put myself at risk, potentially. Or if I know that there's a fight between different people and I can help and I can help calm them down or can help mediate the argument, and I don't do so, that's also nothing, because that could lead to a much bigger problem. I could avoid catastrophe. I could avoid, you know, a war between different people or different families or different who knows what. All of these things are under the category of lo tamor al dam riyacha. Okay, so here we get into that all sorts of people have all sorts of responsibilities. And you can extend this to doctors as well. And this is kind of what we were talking about earlier, that the tov shebaro from legehenim is because if I have the ability to help someone or save someone, and I don't, then I'm culpable. So taken to the extreme, right? Every doctor could, you know, not every doctor is qualified in every single aspect of medicine, but you could argue that if I have the ability to help people, what right do I have to take a day off? What right do I have to not be working, you know, around the clock? Now, obviously, it's unrealistic, and eventually you...
I'm just going to go check if someone's there.
You think someone's there?
Maybe, but I think I realize it's not right to keep the door open. Could be
upstairs. Yeah, we'll put a sign up in the future. I'll put a sign up there.
I think they would have seen.
Yeah, I heard it.
They can hear it, yeah.
Yeah. So, so we can apply this to doctors as well, that they would be, you know, that they would be obligated. That
they can't work around the clock, you're saying. It's unrealistic.
Right. So obviously, you would get to a point of diminishing returns, right? That if you work people to exhaustion,
you're working shifts.
Right. So obviously there's a point where it becomes counterproductive, but for the most part, assuming they can do they do what they can, but they always have this responsibility kind of hanging over their heads.
Anybody there? Oh. Would you close the door?
If somebody comes in, we can hear them opening the door.
Okay, yeah. They'll hear us here also, I think.
That's a good point.
Okay, another source that's used here, and just kind of mention this quickly, this case in Bamidbar is the story of Korach, right? So after Korach rebels against Moshe, challenges his leadership, and he wants to uproot Moshe, and he has this whole group with him. So Hashem punishes Korach and his followers; the ground swallows them up. And the day after, the people begin to complain to Moshe again, and basically saying that Moshe, you killed these people. And Hashem brings a plague in response, because they didn't get the message that Moshe is supposed to be the leader. He's not being out of place. So here we have this the case that in Pasuk Yud, Haremu Metoch Eidah Zot V'Achla Otam Kereg V'Pil Paneihem. So V'Yer Moshe Aram Kach Et Chmachtev Etein El Eish Mezbech Resim Getorot V'Holach Mehera El Eidah V'Kaper Aleihem. So when Hashem tells Moshe that I'm going to bring a plague against the people, Moshe's first response is, let's save them. Okay, so again, people use this as a source to show that our reaction should be to save people when we have the opportunity. Okay, a little bit more esoteric. Next source. So this is the Parash and Mishnah, the Rambam's commentary in the Mishnah on Masech Nedarim, and talks about vows. So he says, Shechayev HaRofe Min Hadin L'Rapot Chole Yisrael. So a doctor is obligated, according to the law, to heal the sick of Israel. V'hari b'chalal amram b'peir b'fer shekasuv v'yashaftalo l'rabos es gufo. So he says, and how do we know, what source does the Torah tell us that we are obligated to heal the sick? So it says v'yashaftalo, meaning it's like returning a lost object. That's how the Rambam puts it, that we have an obligation to return a lost object. So if you have an obligation to return someone's watch or someone's cup, so how much more so would you be obligated to return their health to them, right? So if you have an obligation to return that, then certainly you'd be obligated to return their health. So that's the way the Rambam understands it. See, so the Rambam that's gufam teaches you that you have to, this includes their bodies as well. Shim rehu oved, v'yachal yetzilo, if someone's lost and and you have to return something that's lost. Hari matzilo begufa mono obidiaso. So you have to return it, even hari matzilo begufo. You have to use your body to return something of mono or your money obidiaso or your knowledge. That if you have certain knowledge that can help, you know, let's say, returning a lost object might not just be about I found something in the street and now I return it. If I have information that can lead someone to, right, somebody is trying to figure out, to try to retrace their roots and find access to their Swiss bank account that their parents, their grandparents had opened, you know, before the World War II, right? And I have information that could help them find that account. So that's also considered returning a lost object. My knowledge, I can't do it myself, I can't return the money to them, but I have knowledge that can lead to them reclaiming something that is theirs. So I'm obligated to use my knowledge, the Rambam says, to return things that are lost to people. So to you, he says, that a doctor as well is obligated to heal the sick. So here we have, on one side, we have this overarching obligation that doctors are obligated to heal sick people. We haven't talked about price structures, we haven't talked about fees, we haven't talked about anything. Obviously, that's going to be part of the equation, which we'll get to. But to start, we have this overarching obligation that doctors are obligated to heal people, and it's a religious, sacred responsibility that they have. Okay. Well, let's get to the next page, okay? This is a bit redundant. Let's skip ahead a little bit. So, page 2. So here, now we get into the sense of the government, the government's responsibility. Now, when we're talking about the government in Jewish terms, we're typically talking about the Beis Din, okay? Beis Din had a variety of roles in the Jewish community, okay? They had a legal role, they had a legislative role, but they also had an executive role, I guess you could say, right? They could enact decrees that were not in response to a court case. But if they felt the community needed something, and a lot of the gzeiros, a lot of the decrees we have were based on societal needs and concerns. And so Beis Din really took on a very wide-reaching role, especially the Sanhedrin. Ultimately, Sanhedrin's responsibility was to have their finger on the pulse of society and to know what was needed. And if they felt that certain segments of society were being mistreated, were being taken advantage of, then they would do something about it. Like the ketubah, for example, is probably the best example. So the ketubah was a response to the fact that the system of marriage was unfair to women. Because if a man could divorce his wife and not be obligated to support her afterwards, then it would create an imbalance of power in the relationship. Now, whenever you have an imbalance of power in a relationship, certainly on a communal scale, so now you've got a communal problem. So they would enact a decree and in order to kind of solve that communal problem. So that was more of an executive role than a legislative role, right? So Beis Din played a variety of functions. And we'll see. So here the Gemara in Moed Katan says that Yotzin Lekavis et Drachim L'Tak in the Chovet Eistero. So there were the part of Beis Din's responsibility was to make sure that the roads were clear and that the pathway, you know, that there were no potholes and there were no nothing dangerous in the roads and that they were and that you know, the horses and buggies could go through. That when something happened in the community, on some level it was Basin's responsibility, right? On some level it was Basin's responsibility. And we see this case of the Eglar Rufa that if a person dies between two cities, then both the basins come, whoever's closer has to offer a carbon and has to take some sort of responsibility. Even though we don't think they did it themselves, right? But we have to be concerned that on some level they're part of it. And also, if you go back to page 1, That part of also the idea was that they had to create the Ari Mikla, right? They had to create these cities of refuge, that if somebody was killed accidentally, someone could go and they could take refuge. And based on that, they made sure there were clear signs all throughout the country where these cities were, so that if somebody was killed accidentally, people would know where to go, because, you know, you don't know where to go until you actually need it, right? Like everything in life, you know. Even you look at the hurricane. You know it's coming a few days later, but still everyone's woefully unprepared, right? And hear the government officials say constantly, oh, we didn't know it would be this bad. We didn't know what the scope of the storm would be. Well, it wasn't hidden information, right? So we're ultimately, you know, until it happens, till the emergency happens, we're never really fully prepared for it. So part of Basin's responsibility is to make sure that there is an infrastructure in place, that people are protected, and that here, if someone kills someone else accidentally, then go to these cities so that the family members don't come and kill them out of rage. That was a concern. So, sorry. So here we have Beis Din. So Beis Din has to play that role. But if they don't do their responsibility, then as the pasuk says, the blood is on their hands. Okay. So Beis Din has to take a responsibility for the community. They have to look out for the entirety of the community, the entirety of the Jewish people. They are ultimately responsible. Okay. Any questions before we go on? Any questions, comments? No. Okay. So here we could therefore infer that there's some sort of responsibility that Beis Din has to make sure that there is a healthcare system in place. So how would they do that? So let's talk about a few different things that they would do. Number one, so this is the Sefta Maseches Gittin. Rofe Uman Shiripe Bershus Beis Din. So if someone, a doctor, an expert doctor, who heals people with the permission of Beis Din. So first we see, number one, that Beis Din licensed people. The part of Beis Din's role was to license doctors. Just like in, you know, like in our society, when someone goes to a doctor, they want to have the confidence that this person knows what they're doing. Well, how do we know, how can they know that? So Beis Din would have some sort of licensing system in place that they would verify their education, they're qualified, and they would check up on them. So number one, to be a doctor, you have to be a licensed Beis Din doctor. So let's say you're one of those people, you're one of those doctors. V'hizik b'shogeg pater b'mezit chayev mipnei tikun olam. So if you damage somebody accidentally, okay, then the doctor is pater. Right, there is no malpractice insurance. There's no malpractice. You cannot sue for malpractice according to Jewish law, unless it was, you know, chay b'mezid.
What's pater?
You are exempt.
Couldn't mezid mean negligence, like really egregious negligence?
It could be. We'll get into a little more of the.
Like somebody did something that no. I believe the standard is that, you know, a reasonable something that falls below the competence level of a medical.
Yeah, you can make that argument. Yeah, I think so.
Actually, it sounds more criminal. It sounds like the Torah's definition of being able to sue a doctor. If he does something deliberately, that's like criminal.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
Like, that's right. That's not.
It's no longer the role of a doctor anymore. You're no longer a doctor at that point.
You're not suing. Anytime you're suing, it's more because the doctor was negligent. He failed to do something, as you pointed out,
that he should have known. Mazid here would mean he's intentionally harming somebody.
Right.
Or else he would be liable for whatever the Torah analog is to assault and battery and such, or even murder. So Mazid here cannot mean that he's acting. Chayav means that he's chayav but actually when you harm somebody intentionally, you're also chayav. That's also a civil thing where you pay.
Yeah, we'll get to that, yes.
Suing exists, like if you
you know, the idea, like, I guess, like, if you borrowed something from somebody and you mishandled it and it fell apart, you're obligated to compensate, you know, that.
Well,
so if you don't, if you made a pair of shoes for someone and it doesn't fit or you didn't do it right, or likewise, if you're a doctor and you didn't treat him right, you diagnosed wrong and you gave him the wrong medicine, so there wouldn't be anything that the doctor is obligated?
So the doctor would not be obligated.
Yeah.
Right.
But in other professions, they would be.
In other professions, you could say. Meaning, if you were a tailor and you were hired to tailor a suit, and the guy tries it on and doesn't fit, so then they have a right to say, "Fix the suit," and I'm not going to pay for the alteration.
Falls apart after a week.
Or maybe if you could demonstrate that it was not done to quality. Yes. Yeah, so then. That's not suing, really. You're asking for, you know, damages, right? But now you're in the world of replacing lost, replacing objects, of fair, of getting your fair money's worth, of getting what you paid for. But here, when it comes to there's two exceptions to the rule. We'll see. One is Beis Din. That if Beis Din offers a judgment that's incorrect, and someone's punished or even put to death for it. If Beis Din acted judiciously and they acted according to their best knowledge of the situation, so that you can't then come and sue Beis Din, right? Or they can't be held liable for a criminal act. If they acted according to the law as they saw it, with good intention, I'm saying there's no funny business whatsoever, they'll make mistakes. And the second one here is doctors, that doctors are given this dispensation. Why? So Tosefta says, for the good of the world. Right. How is this for the good of the world? What do you think it means? What do you think it means for the good of the world?
Because doctors would be afraid to treat anybody otherwise.
Right.
That's why I believe in New York there's a Good Samaritan law where a doctor who sees happens upon the scene of an accident can treat the injured person without fear of being arrested or subject to damages should the treatment not pay out.
Right. So that's the situation you have here is that it's the two issues. Number one is doctors will be afraid to try to heal people. Number two, people won't go into the profession, right? Which happens, and certainly as our society has gotten more litigious and malpractice insurance can go in certain states well into the six figures. So it becomes a disincentive to go into the field. So if we want our best and brightest, then we have to offer a certain amount of leeway to doctors, knowing they won't be perfect. And knowing that even good doctors can make bad mistakes, as long as they're mistakes. So that's the first way they kept healthcare costs down. You can't sue doctors. No, tort reform was, and this comes up. This came up more in the 2008 debates, from what I remember. This is more of a discussion in 2008. I haven't heard it in these debates, in this election cycle, as a factor in healthcare costs. But if you ask doctors, right? We had a little discussion with Charles Schutters 2 weeks ago. We asked the doctors at the table, and you asked them, you know, what they think the healthcare reform is needed. So there are a few different ideas, but certainly one is malpractice insurance is so out of whack. It makes it very, very difficult. And then you've got to charge a lot, and then you can't accept everyone because you've got to worry about your insurance. You've got to pay your bills, and also every patient is now a potential lawsuit. So, the first thing that the Beis Din did was that as long as the person was licensed, again, they had to be licensed. If someone's not licensed, you go to them, and then you guys work it out. But as long as they're licensed by Beis Din, then you have to give them certain leeway. The Beis Yosef puts it as follows. V'yesh lo mede rofe kedayim mitzav aladun. That we look at a doctor just like a judge. That the judge is obligated to judge. Vim tal below hoda and alav onus klal. And if the judge does his job properly, and ultimately they make a bad judgment, and that can even to the extreme lead to someone getting the death penalty when they shouldn't. You can't hold the judge liable because then no one would ever judge, right? Shema yomar adayin mali betzar is a because then people would say, why would I want to get involved in this? If I make a mistake, an honest mistake, I'm gonna get punished for murder? Right? What kind of job is this? Who would do it? So almost by definition, you have to allow for mistakes. Ultimately, we say that when it comes to judgment, it's based on what the judge sees. We have to allow them that leeway. However, what could happen potentially is if Beis Din is hiring people they shouldn't, if Beis Din is giving, you know what, I'm going to hold off on this. Now hold off on this because we're going to get this later on. So hold off on this. Okay, so how do they handle the situation? So, So as long as they're not doing it on purpose. So how do they judge these cases? How do we handle situations? So there's not malpractice suits, but Beis Din would have to determine how to handle situations when there is damages and where there's injury. So the Mishnah lays out, there's five different things that I pay somebody for. If one person injures another person. So what are they? So if I injure somebody else, I'm potentially obligated to pay them for five things. For the overall damages, which I'll explain in a second. Tsar, which is the amount of pain they suffer. Riboy, I have to pay the doctor's bills. Shevet, I have to pay their lost wages. Uboshet, I have to pay for the embarrassment they suffered. So let's go through what these are. So what is Nezek? So Nezek is the overall financial loss of a human being. What does that mean? So what they would do is they would determine the value the person would have had as a slave before the injury and after the injury. Why? They're not a slave. The idea is that how do you determine the financial value of a human being? Right? What? I mean, obviously, human life is not calculable. But if you talk about the potential earnings of a person, right? So the way they would do it is, the best way to do it was, if someone was a skilled laborer, right? So if they were a slave in the open market, those in that market would want to hire them. And they would have a certain value. So if they were an accountant, so, you know, think about like Shawshank Redemption, right? So if you're a prisoner who happens to be a star accountant, then you'll do pretty well. So the more skills you have, then you're going to be worth more in the open market. If you're an unskilled laborer, then you'll, you know, be worth much less. So when you take into account your overall financial worth, so that's Nezek. Then they had Sheves, the amount of time that you're off of work, meaning for any job, that you get paid as well. But then you get paid some things that are a little bit more, that are harder to define. For example, Tsar and Boshet. Tsar is pain. So how do you determine pain, right? So that's something you'll have in American law, right? Pain and suffering. What's it called? There's a better term for it. There's emotional pain and suffering, physical pain and suffering.
Emotional distress.
So you can sue for that, yeah. Right? How do you put a financial value on emotional distress?
They usually testify what they can, used to be able to do, now they cannot do, and they had to go to the psychiatrist. And they wake up, they can't sleep.
So how do you put a number on that?
There are precedents, and they can get expert witnesses to testify put some sort of monetary value on that.
Right.
And ultimately, it's either the jury's call, or in some cases, it might be the judge's false monetary.
Right, but the jury could award $10 million for emotional distress if they feel that is fair in this situation.
Well, the jury can do anything they please, and afterwards it can be appealed.
Right. But I'm saying it's hard. So here the Torah has certain objective standards for this. So the way they put it is, for the pain, the physical pain, because you've been injured, so the question is, basically, how much would you have been willing to pay to have this same injury without the pain? What's that worth to you? Right? Meaning, you're going to the dentist and you're going to get a root canal. So, how much would you pay for the anesthetic? Would you pay $500? Yeah. Would you pay $10,000? I don't know. Would you pay $100,000? No. You know what? I could suck it up for $100,000, right? There's a price point. There's a point where I'm willing to pay to not have the pain. that is, for that individual, what would that person have been willing to pay based on the financial circumstances? And again, they still have, Basin has to figure it out still, but that's kind of how they do it. So they try to limit the cost on some level, and that's how they try to figure it out. Okay, let's go to the next stage. Who can be a doctor? I want to move on a little bit. Who can be a doctor? So the Shulchan Aruch says as follows. Page 3. Hanota ilanat lebnei ha-medina. If somebody, you're a government worker, okay? So you cut trees for the government. That's your job, right? Your job, you're a logger. Shehifsi, and you do a bad job. Chen tavach shel bnei ha'ir shenevel ha-behemos. Or you're a shochet for the community, and you're doing a bad job, and you keep doing it wrong and making animals not kosher. Or you're a doctor that's licensed and you keep messing up and you keep hurting people. Or you're a scribe and you keep messing up your documents. Or you're a teacher and you're doing a terrible job and kids aren't learning anything. Anything where your job is, you're involved in the public good, you're being paid in public good, but it's becoming clear that you are not really cut out for this work. Now, in American law, right? America, it's great to be a government worker. Why? Because you can never be fired, right? That's what they say. So what can Basin do? So the Basin has the right to remove people from their positions without warning. The moment they feel they are incapable of doing this job, Basin has the right to remove them from the post. Shehem kimutarim ve'omdim. It's basically as if, according to the Shulchan Aruch, according to the Yosef Cairo,
You're fired.
Meaning you're always on warning, right? From the moment you work for the public good, the understood agreement is that you can be removed at any time.
I mean, usually by law, like in a lot of companies, like they have to give you like a couple warnings and then they fire you. They have to give you a verbal warning and a written warning.
Right, exactly, right.
They can't just fire you. You can't just walk into work and then you're fired.
Actually speaking, unless there's an employment contract or some sort of, what's the equivalent in employment, handbook, NERC is, I believe, what's it called?
An at-will?
Employment at-will state. They can without that, they can just fire whenever they please, why ever they please, unless it can be shown that they're practicing some sort of racial discrimination or disability discrimination and so forth and so on.
Yeah, according to the Labor Department, you can't discriminate, you have to hire anybody and everybody.
Right, so.
Any type of discrimination.
Yeah, right.
But strictly speaking, they can fire whenever they want, without much discrimination.
Right. So Ashi Shadlu b'malachtam hove midu otam hatzibor lehem So since this is a communal good, so you can be fired at any point. But the Ramah says he says v'yeshurim to afa pi she'ain tzrichem atzra. Even though you don't have to warn them to fire them, mikomakam be'inan chazaka. They need to demonstrate a pattern of incompetence. Ta'achi muzakim o shitir behen lo masakin lo. So you can't really. They make one mistake, you're going to fire them, that you can't do. A chazak is usually three times. They have to exhibit some sort of pattern, kind of what you're saying, a warning, two warnings. So they have to establish a pattern. Once they establish a pattern, then you can remove them from their post. So part of Basin's responsibility was to keep up on, and doctors are included. They had to make sure that doctors were doing their job. Okay, price controls for medical needs. So how would they establish price controls? So the Gemara says as follows. This is a Gemara in Baba Kama Daf Kuf Tav Tedzai. Harshay Bereach Mi Beit HaSirim Vaita Meuveras Lefanav. Amar Tol Dinar Vavareni Ein Lo Alas Charo. So here's the case. Let's say somebody escapes from jail. Okay. Now it doesn't mean that they right. This is where they're being held against their will. We've seen very often Jews would be considered to be being held against their will. So let's say you're in a situation where you're on the run or you're in desperate need, and now you get to a river and you've got some money, and the person who has the ferry realizes that he's got you where he wants you. Because if he can charge you whatever he wants, because the moment, because you need him to survive. If you don't cross this river, you're going to get caught. So he says, usually it costs $5 to cross on the ferry. He says, give me $500. Okay? So you agree to the price, and then you cross the river. How much do you owe him? That's the question. That's the Gemara's question. So it says, Ein lo el shcharo. You only have to pay him what he normally gets paid. Right? Why? So, amar le mishatani bekach. Because you can just say, I was joking. You weren't literally joking. But what you're saying is, you're not obligated to pay the ransom. To, you know, you're not obligated to pay when you're being held up like that. So, in this, you know, there are two types of there are two types of goods and services in the world, right? There's elastic services and there are inelastic services, right? So you learn this in Economics 101. Elastic services are things that, if you change the price point, so then the demand will go down, right? So, you know, people love Reese's peanut butter cups, right? But if you start charging $10 a package, suddenly demand will go down, right? Because the price affects the demand, right? Elastic services, or if the economy is bad, then people start buying less of it, right? The price is the demand is dependent on the people's ability to pay. But certain things are inelastic, right? Certainly healthcare often falls into the category of an inelastic good. If you need a certain heart medicine to survive, so how much will you pay for it? Well, now that's not dependent anymore, right, on my financial situation because I need it to survive. So there is no limit to what I will pay. So to a certain extent, what makes a medical economy so complicated is it's an inelastic good. The market can't really regulate the prices. That's the problem. The market can't regulate the prices because ultimately people will pay because they need it. Now, certain, you know, plastic surgery, you could say, you know, or things that are optional or cosmetic, so that you could say is elastic, right? Dependent on your financial situation. But certainly, integral medical needs are inelastic services. So how do you regulate a market that's... So you have to regulate a market that's inelastic. Otherwise, people will take advantage. It's going to be like this person who's holding you up because you want to cross the river. So in order for this to happen, we have to have some sort of government regulation. And this became a big part of also how they kept healthcare costs down. So they had kept healthcare costs down, number one, because of... because there was no, you couldn't sue for malpractice. And number two, they capped the prices. So here's there's a general category of this in the next source of called Ona, that you're not allowed to make more than 1/6 profit on something, right? That you can't overcharge. And they limited profit again to ensure that there's some sort of safety in the marketplace. Because people wouldn't always necessarily know what things cost. You couldn't take advantage of people. But here when it comes to healthcare, certainly this applied. So let's see. Let's go down a few sources. Yeah?
Yeah. What is this 1/6?
So you can make 1/6 profit on any good that had an objective price to it.
Like if the procedure costs $50.
So we get to medical cases. I mean, this is in the general marketplace, right? If the Toyota Camry costs $24,000, then I can sell it for $36,000, unless I can demonstrate why this car should be worth more, right? Because then I might just be fooling people, taking advantage of them. Now, certain goods, by definition, don't have set prices, right? What's a Picasso worth, right? Well, it depends. I mean, certain things have a limited value. The market really does define the value of it because, you know, it doesn't have a set price. Certainly, if it's a unique item or one in a million, but for regular goods and services, there'd be a price point to make sure that the marketplace had some sort of controls. And certainly, because then you get into monopolies, and then you could, you know, undercut people or buy out your, and then you could buy out your competition, and then pretty soon prices will skyrocket. So if you limit profit, it disincentivizes people to try to undercut their competitors. So Shulchan Aruch says, this is in Hechos Biker Cholim, Urafua. So not that Torah should lerofe lerapo. So the Torah gives permission for the doctor to heal, mitzvah, and it's a mitzvah for them to heal. Of a chalap pikuch nefesh, it's part of the mitzvah of saving lives. And you refuse to heal someone, then it's as if you are killing someone. So, since you uniquely can do it, you have to do. You shouldn't heal people unless you really have the skill to do so. Well, let me skip a little bit here. If you try to heal without permission based in, so then you can be punished as well. Okay, let me skip to the next one. Let's say you sell medicine. And somebody needs the medicine. You can't overcharge the person because you know they need them to live. Or they need them desperately. Since medicine is an inelastic good, you are not allowed to overcharge for it. Even if the person gave you the money, that even if you agreed on a price, instead of $50, you agreed on $500, and then you gave him the medicine, he only has to pay you $50. It's an inelastic good, and therefore, Basin will control this, and they'll enforce this, that you're not allowed to overcharge for healthcare. And here you get into the other issue is, when it comes to the price of healthcare, you're allowed to have a profit, certainly let's say the pharmaceutical end, right? And that certainly has become one of the big rising costs of healthcare is the medicines that people need, certainly the elderly. So they would cap profit. You can make 1/6. That's your capped profit. Now you can include R&D into that. So R&D can be part of the cost of building something because obviously you have to incentivize research and development. But at the same time, the basin can come and cap your profit to make sure that there's some sort of control. You'll make a healthy profit. 1/6 is certainly a healthy profit, but you can't go beyond that, and they would enforce that. So here you'd have, so one way they're going to keep healthcare costs down is no malpractice. Number two, capping profits for medicines. That's the second thing. And here we have a case of the Ravaz, says that, kind of echoing this. And a third thing, and to add to this, is a general culture. And that is, a doctor has to realize that on some level, there has to be a culture of giving back as well. And in order for a healthcare system to really provide to everyone, the medical community has to be willing to kind of pick up the slack on some level and realize that at times they will be providing services that they will be underpaid for, right? And while you can enforce the cost of medicines, it's harder to do on services. It's hard to do on doctor's visits. It's hard to do on surgeries because there is not a set price for it. And certainly procedures that are done infrequently, it's much harder to cap it. You can cap on some level, but it's much harder to do so. And so ultimately, you really need a system and a culture that doctors pick up this slack and are willing and able to at least donate some of their time or for less money or even for no money at times. Okay, so for example, there's a very very nice Gemara here. Just I'm going to go too late. Do one or two more sources here. There's a very nice Gemara. Turn to the last page. To the fifth page. Turn to the fifth page. So just to add one thing here, we see that we never want people to break the bank. That if you look at the source here in Gittin, the that even to ransom someone, they would cap how much the community would have to pay for it. The community was not obligated to impoverish themselves to save someone. Even though you say, well, you can say a life is more valuable than all their money, so it was considered to be a counteracting need that the community not be impoverished to save one person. There's a famous case of the Maharam of Rutenberg, one of the most famous rabbis of his era in the Middle Ages, who was taken captive, and he did not allow the community to pay the ransom for him, because he felt, A, it would impoverish them, and B, then it would just embolden the thieves to keep doing it. And so he allowed himself to die in captivity in order to preserve the community. So here you have to have this. There's a communal responsibility that the same. While there's a sense that you have to have health, communal health care, we're not obligated to impoverish ourselves or to borrow money in order for the system to work. So there has to be some sort of middle ground. And ultimately, the problem with any healthcare system is, when do you say no, right? Can you say no to certain procedures because, you know, and who's determining what procedures somebody needs and what they and what the community can afford? Meaning there's no end to how much we could provide to everybody, right? You know, we should all have our own personal doctors who should have checkups every day, and boy, then we would be much better off. So obviously there's going to be a limit, and we have to find a limit, but certainly there's not an obligation to impoverish the community. And also there's a strong responsibility that people have to take care of themselves. That you lose certain health care rights if you have not taken care of your own health. And so here there's a source here in Shulchan Aruch, Hilchos Shudfim Siman Kuf Ayin Zayin, that let's say somebody goes out into the cold and you know gets pneumonia, so we're limited in how much we have to help them to a certain extent. If somebody is negligent in how they take care of themselves, and then expects the community to be the ones responsible, so we can cap that. At some level, you can cap that and say, look, there's a strong sense that people have to take care of themselves. There's certainly exceptions to the rule, and certainly people, you know, but if something happens not because of negligence, then the community is a lot more responsible, but there is a sense of personal responsibility. So I'm going to end with this Gemara. So Gemara says, Abba, Umna hava ase le shama mi mesifta derikia kol yoma. So his man, his name is Abba Umna, so he would, so from Shemayim, he would get a shalom from Shemayim, like the angels in heaven would say hello to him every day. But Abaye would only have that only happened to him on Shabbos. So Abaye, the leader of the generation, he would only, literal, but would only feel that heaven was reaching out to him on Shabbos. But this particular doctor, he'd have it every single day. Rava, this only happened to him in Yom Kippur, so even less frequently. So Abaye was wondering, how come this guy gets it every single day, and this only happens to me on Shabbos? So Amru Lo, he was told, "Lom matzis lemei vaikuvde," because you're not as great as he is. So my have uvda dabu umna. What was his greatness? Chiyava milsa have a machas gavri lachud or nashid lachud. So there's certain things that he was a doctor. He would have separate areas for men and women, so it would be modest. But beyond that, go to the next page. V'izle duchta detzniya deshade be pshita deshakel. And he also, there was a certain amount of modesty in how people paid. So he would have, like, a box where people would pay. And he would never know how much money they were paying for their visit. And the expectations, people would pay what they could afford. He wouldn't even know what the individual was paying. They would, right? And if a young like rabbinical student would come, he wouldn't charge him anything. So he would provide health care, and he had a sliding scale. And part of his services was there was a sliding scale. So he took it upon himself. So this was considered to be the tzaddik of his generation because he was providing health. He was getting paid. But he's providing a sliding scale. He took it upon himself. There's some responsibility in him himself. And so here, if we get into a situation where doctors are donating time or working in clinics and doing that on a regular basis, and certainly with some preventative care, So that ultimately would go a long way. Someone could say that's kind of what residents do already. But that goes a long way in making sure that healthcare costs are down for everybody because it provides some sort of system. So these are some ideas. Obviously, there's a lot more to it, and this is just... but here's kind of a little bit of a snapshot as to some ways that we've handled this in our communities throughout Jewish history, some sources to kind of give us some perspective. So, any questions about... All right?
So you were going to touch upon the topic, how does it translate to put an obligation on government itself?
So government has a responsibility, meaning based in had a responsibility. Based on a responsibility to make sure that costs were down, to make sure that doctors were protected, to make sure that there was a licensing system in place. And there was a communal responsibility to make sure healthcare was provided. At the same time, they were not obligated to impoverish themselves in the process. So that was the flip side. So they would try to find some sort of middle ground. But it was definitely a communal responsibility. It was definitely a based in responsibility. Yeah, 100%.
But the Melech had no part in this.
The Melech
is actually the analog of government in our day, Malchut.
Yeah, the Melech didn't really. Yeah, this is more
so
local.
It would be unacceptable for anybody to be left untreated. And the system that they had, you're saying that everybody would be eligible for...
There was some protection for everybody. You know, again, it was depending on in the city what they could afford. It wasn't guaranteed that everybody could get every treatment, certainly on demand. That was not necessarily a fair expectation. But they tried to create some sort of system in place that there would be... If you keep the cost down, if there's no overcharging, if there's some sort of objective standard of what people would pay... If you can limit costs to doctors by not having malpractice insurance, they felt that they were to keep it down enough, you know, that there would be. And if you have a sense of communal responsibility, then doctors would help to, you know, take care of others.
So would you say that the system, the medical model that's in Israel today, is closer to the Torah model.
Much closer.
Than the United States.
Much closer.
Because I know in America, with Obamacare, it just doesn't work
right
in this country.
Well, Obamacare is not this. Obamacare is a mix of... It's mostly private.
It's more to debt than anything else.
Well, we don't know that.
It
could be. It could be just the opposite, according to him.
But Obamacare still relies a lot on private insurance companies.
They've already saved a lot of money in the past.
But Obamacare still relies on a lot of private insurance companies.
But this doesn't oppose private.
Well, there's no concept of a private insurance company.
Well, in Israel, they provide free health care for everybody.
Right, taxes are higher and people pay for it.
Like the socialized medicine, you could pay and go to someone private on your own if you're willing.
They take out more taxes on your income to, I guess, make up for it.
Yeah, so taxes are much higher.